We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. To kickstart the new year, if you haven't already, you can download the Meditation Studio app in the App Store, where you'll find our new Motivation Collection with meditations designed to help you create new habits and make all your 2019 dreams come true. Later in January, you'll enjoy lots of new original music tracks to add to new deep sleep meditations and meditations for your kiddos. Our app is like having a little inspirational coach in your pocket when you're facing any challenge. If you have a minute, will you give us a review on the app and the podcast? It helps a lot to get the word out. And any comments for us, reach out at founders@meditationstudioapp.com. Today's guest is Lama Tsomo, one of the first American women to be ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist Lama or spiritual teacher. She was born Linda Pritzker and is part of the family that built the Hyatt Hotel chain. On her website, it says she has two inheritances, one from birth, one she earned, the first financial, the second spiritual. She embarked on a very different path from her family, studying Tibetan Buddhism for years and even teaching herself to speak and understand Tibetan fluently so that she could study with her chosen teacher. Motivated by her desire to find happiness for herself and others, she has experience as a psychotherapist, and she has her continuing path of spiritual inquiry. She's the author of the book, Why is the Dalai Lama Always Smiling? A Westerner's Guide to Tibetan Buddhist Practice, and she's founder of the Namchok Retreat Ranch in Western Montana. She's also a mom and a grandmother, so she's quite a fascinating human being. Now, here's Lama Tsomo. Hi, Lama Tsomo. It is so great to have you on Untangle today. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so happy to be here, Patricia.
Great. So I want to really start with understanding your childhood. Tell us a little bit about how you would describe yourself as a 10-year-old.
Where my mind went was when I was about to have, I think it was maybe my 8th birthday. It was actually the night before. Is that cheating?
No, that's perfect.
Okay, great. I don't know why. My mind just suddenly went to the night before my birthday when I was going to turn 8. I was still 7. And I was doing my homework of thinking, what's going to be my wish for when I blow out the candles? This is very important.
Wow, good planning.
I'm going to be 8. Yeah, I was a little bit of a planner. So I was planning it out and that you only get one wish a year, right? So it's, you want to make it count. I taught myself to read because I was an early riser and would get bored and I just would sound out from the alphabet and just got ahead of myself with that. And I loved reading fairy tales. I remembered in the fairy tales that whenever somebody had 3 wishes, they usually screwed it up. And it would seem like good things they were wishing for, but it always kind of got messed up somehow. So I thought, okay, now I really have to figure this out because I don't want any loopholes to make it go the wrong way. So I'm trying to figure out what am I going to wish for? And everything, there was a way that it could turn bad. So finally, I just thought, the whole bottom line is I want to be happy. So I'm going to wish to be happy. And I was trying to think, well, how could that get screwed up? And I was thinking and thinking, I was saying, well, I could end up being like village idiot. You know, something could happen to my brain capacities. And then what? Well, but if I'm happy, that's the bottom line. It's okay. So that was what I wished for. And I did for many, many, many years after.
Did you, each year you wished to be happy, that became your wish?
Yes. And then I, of course, decided to, because I was a planner, I decided to find out some techniques beyond wishing when you blow out candles. And so that led me to studying psychology, which I was already doing in high school, and found my way through Freud to Carl Jung. And then I was also pursuing things spiritual, looking at that. I was studying I Ching at age 13. Wow. You know, I was very interested in this stuff. How can we hack life?
Where did that come from? Because in the book, you said that you dealt with depression growing up and that you grew up in a family that had all its physical requirements taken care of, but not all of our emotional needs. And that your parents were, I think you used these words, good-hearted, but neurotic, and you were kind of lonely and sad. And at the same time, you had this sense of understanding that you shared in the book that your parents were human and that we're all imperfect. Did the wishing to be happy come from a place of sadness? And what was your understanding of that at that time?
By high school, I was depressed. And I think there were a number of people in high school who were depressed. I could see that the people around me hadn't hacked life very well themselves. Everybody was doing what I was doing, which is pursuing happiness pretty much all day, every day. And we try to push away suffering. And we do that not only all day long, but even in our dreams. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm looking at the adults around me. And I have to say, I grew up and became a parent. I have three kids. And I was another neurotic human being who was a parent and doing the best they could. I think this is the human condition that we're talking about. We aren't always happy, even though we really try to pursue that.
Yeah.
Just because I like trying to figure things out. And my dad, for bedtime stories, would read me from like a book on relativity and things like that. I had this mind that was fascinated and passionate about learning how do human beings' minds work and how does the universe work and what's the relationship between the two. I just had this burning passion around understanding that. And that was a driving force for me in and of itself. But I think also, as a human being who is driven to be happy and to push away suffering, I had that driving me as well.
So would you say from a very pretty young age, you were wired to ask a lot of questions about life and of yourself? And did you write in a journal as you were in junior high school and high school?
I was. I mean, yeah. Just at age 13, we were on a vacation and my parents took us along to little shops wherever we were. And we went into a bookshop because we are all kind of bookish in my family. And I picked up the I Ching and was fascinated by it and brought it home and was devouring it. I think because there was a love of learning around me that I loved it. And fortunately, I went to a school that didn't kill that.
Right.
Yeah. So I just continued being fascinated, following my interest.
Do you think it's this combination of your innate curiosity and coupled with your going through the ups and downs of life as a teenager and maybe being a little bit depressed that kind of led you on your spiritual journey, those two things kind of running in parallel?
Well, yes. So yeah. You know, life wasn't always a happy thing, despite my always pursuing that. I wanted to find better ways to handle life.
Tell me a little bit about your early meditation experience after you had your three kids and were living on the farm. I think you mentioned that you were doing 15-minute daily meditations and then stopped to find a quote-unquote real teacher.
I was way out in rural Wisconsin with a couple of goats and kids running around. And I was reading stuff on my own, but that's not the same as getting real instruction. So my meditations were not great. I thought you were supposed to turn off your mind and like pushing pause on a video or something. It turns out that's not what you're trying to do. And I didn't know that. I didn't get really what I was trying to do there with meditation, but it seemed like a good idea. When I was doing those 15-minute a day meditations, as terrible as they probably were, I was coming to myself every day. I would see something that was important to me bubbling up. And also, I just, having come to myself a little bit once a day, then all the thousands of decisions I was making during the day were coming more from my deeper self. That caused me to say, if I'm going to meditate, again, my deliberate planning self, wouldn't it be like playing piano? I had studied piano, and it turns out it really helps if you find a teacher who's good at piano, reasonably good at teaching, and then you practice every day. Turns out you get better. So I decided to go find a teacher.
What kind of meditation were you doing?
That's another thing. It was just sort of generic, sitting there saying, I'm meditating and I'm trying to calm my mind and not reacting to stuff on the outside, but just being with myself. And that's really all I knew.
You were self-taught then. You kind of learned on your own how to meditate and then got restless with it.
Well, I don't know how much learning there was back then.
Okay.
It's just sitting there being quiet and hoping that my mind was settling a bit and slowing down a bit. And every time I realized I'd gotten off into some self-made movie that I was watching,
right.
You know, I'd go, oh yeah, I was meditating, come back, which actually is part of meditation, but I didn't know it at the time.
Right.
I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm terrible at this. And by the way, that's very ego-focused. You're still focused on
right.
yourself and your other movie. But, you know, I didn't find that out till later. So the very first instruction I got was when I was, I'm going to say 40. I went to a weekend retreat. By then I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein were teaching. That's how I got my first instruction, which is kind of a wonderful thing.
Yeah. That, I mean, if you're going to get your first instruction, those are the two people to get it from. That's
right.
Awesome. Yeah.
And then Sharon came back and did a metta retreat. So I had the balance of Vipassana and metta. And then I was listening to recordings of them teaching. And so that was my first entry into meditation with instruction.
And did that change everything for you?
I was gradually getting more and more on track. It was definitely helping. As I was doing those meditations now with instruction and beginning to gradually develop some ability with it, I was feeling clearer and calmer. But this was a really gradual process. Mainly, it's just kind of one foot in front of the other, rewiring your brain using these very efficient time-tested techniques. And along the way, I just got more and more on track for myself and more happy and more able to handle the challenges that were coming my way. And I still couldn't prevent them all. But when they came, I got thrown less. And even in the moment, I was more able to come with an open heart and compassion and skill. So wisdom and compassion in dealing with those tough moments.
When you talk about your aura, that you felt your aura was dirty, in the book you say, we merely have to clean the windshield of confused seeing and we're restored to our true state. Is that what you mean?
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries, so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. .com/untangle. Now back to our show.
What is this process of sort of cleaning the windshield?
What I meant when I was talking about cleaning the windshield is more my view of life. As I look out, I'm looking through a windshield that's kind of splattered and warped and colored and everything. And then I look out and I see what I'm calling reality, when actually a whole lot of it is the pattern of my windshield. And a rather small percentage of it is whatever is beyond the windshield. I think I'm not alone in that. I think we all are dreaming up our reality more than we realize. So that's really what I meant by the windshield metaphor. And these methods helped me to slow down, have a bit of a gap, and those kinds of things in my general knee-jerk reactions to life. But what also happens is I begin to see life differently. So for example, if somebody in front of me is being ornery, and normally I would see them as, oh, this ornery person. And maybe they remind me of somebody I knew before who was ornery or something like that. I'm not really seeing that human being very much. And what's happened for me as I've meditated over the years is more and more and sooner, I'm able to get down to more our common humanness that's underneath the moment of orneriness, or even maybe that person is often angry, but that is a surface thing, and more who, what they are, because I've gone deeply into seeing who, what I am underneath the various waves of emotions that come and go. When you can see on that deeper level, that changes everything. Now you're seeing life as it really is much more.
So I've meditated for 20 something years. I get triggered and I am in a very annoyed state, but I know how to pause. And I think many of us do. And we talk about getting off of autopilot and pausing. But I think what you're saying is there's another step where you're not taking things so personally, and where you're able to see past that person who has triggered you.
Yeah. And I'm going to start with a really surface reframing that helps me not to get triggered. I came across this metaphor way after I had already kind of figured out to do this, but I love the metaphor. There's a book called The Law of the Garbage Truck.
I love the name.
Right?
Yes.
And he's talking about when people come and dump, right? When they dump at your doorstep and you just don't accept the garbage. It's not my garbage. I don't have to accept that.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, so I just don't take it in the door. It's way less efficient to take it in the door and then have to go through a huge process and forgiveness and all these kinds of things. Why accept it in the first place? So if I haven't accepted the garbage, I'm not as triggered. And then I'm actually able to be present with the person, and we can often get past what was originally a difficult exchange or something difficult was coming toward me. Now I can come with something very different and like stretch out an open hand to that person. And quite often they then respond quite differently. They sometimes turn on a dime and really soften themselves. Other times they don't, and that's okay. Right. Wish them well and they go on their way and you haven't accepted the garbage. And I really have to make a big caveat here, because sometimes we get feedback from people that we do need to hear.
Right.
So then sorting that out becomes a level of skill that may take some developing. And again, meditation can help with that discernment.
Do you see that as like certain things in relationship turn a mirror on the things that we need to look at and maybe areas where we need to grow? Is that sort of what you're saying? And we need to sort of know the difference, right?
Yes. And I don't just mean in live relationships, even the one with the person next to you in the line at the store who's annoyed by something you're doing, which may be something you're really doing that's problematic, or it may be that it's just their annoyance and they don't want to be waiting in line and they've got other stuff going on in their lives. And so if we know that we don't have to accept the garbage, I think that already gives us the liberty and a little bit more space. I didn't have to accept whatever neurosis was theirs, but is there a piece of learning for me that I want to take?
Yeah. And is that what you're able to do in that moment? Or is it later when you're in your meditation that you reflect on these things?
Of course, you think about it afterwards. And how you think about it is key, I think. And so if I think of it as clearly some of this was just their own triggering, now let me just look and see, is there anything in what I did that I could improve on? And because I've practiced self-compassion, there's a practice called Donglin in Tibetan Buddhist array of practices. I can afford to look at, oh gosh, the tone of my voice was not kind enough, or I didn't really notice them. And isn't that already less awareness than I want to have, especially around fellow human beings? Was there some piece of what I said, how could I have said that better and come from a better place so that I can improve? If I know that I'm basically made of the same perfection that makes all of manifested reality, if that's my true root of being, and I've sat with that enough, then I can afford to look at that. And I'm not going to immediately go into self-hate and, oh, you know, I'm a terrible person and all that judgmental stuff.
Well, if you had to put into a nutshell how your life has changed both from the inside and the outside since becoming a lama, how would you describe that?
I actually asked Rinpoche. I said, I just don't know if I'm improving because I'm with me all the time. This was, oh gosh, like I don't know, nearly 20 years ago, I remember asking him this. And he said, well, are you more self-centered or less? Are you able to practice compassion more or less? It usually doesn't stay exactly the same, but if it's the same, okay, then that's what it is. And I have to say, I just habitually respond with more compassion. I feel more compassion and I feel much happier. And I feel the world to be filled with compassion. We're swimming in a sea of joy and compassion, and we're so distracted, we just don't notice it. And that windshield is pretty fogged up. So we just don't notice it. But the root of all of our being is like this great ocean of awareness that is pure compassion and pure joy. Mm. And we're all these unique waves that ocean generates because it's just what oceans do. So we're all these fellow waves on this big ocean, and we're all made of water together. And that's a very different experience. And I've sat in that experience enough that more and more I'm actually living from that and less from such a surface level distracted mind that sees me as this one wave and everybody and everything else separate.
Oh, that's so beautiful. You ask in the book, are you as happy as you want to be? And I am so curious about what does it entail for us to be as happy as we want to be? And do you think it's possible? And I think you maybe have answered this a little bit, that this set of methods can help us be happy even when life is filled with difficulty and pain. What does happy mean to you?
Ultimate happiness is opening up the boundaries of what I consider to be me or I to include all the ocean, all the waves, the whole ocean, all the way down to the bottom, all of it. So what I'm really talking about is waking up fully to that and living fully from that. Remember, the word Buddha literally means one who's awake.
Yeah.
And the Buddha believes strongly in Sangha, spiritual
community. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was one of the three jewels. So at Namchak, we believe strongly in that part, because to actually live from this place, you have to believe it. And you don't want to believe it out of blind faith, but out of experience. But it helps to have other people who are seeing the same or similar things. That's true if you go to a rock concert or a political rally is a great example. People get fired up, whether they're at a Trump rally, or I heard from friends who went to Obama rallies. People in a group, you can really see it in those contexts, really infect each other with a point of view and a perspective and a feeling. And in many groups, our own change and transformation happens much more strongly, and especially in the face of adversity, if we have a group of people who we're all kind of serving as mirrors for each other, whether we know it or not. But to have a group of people who are pursuing something like this together, where we're all going home and sitting on our own cushions and really deeply, as much as we can, sitting in that root of reality kind of place. And when we forget, we remember and then come back again and again. And then we come together and we support each other. And the experience of group meditation is quite different and also important. So both and, just like if you're a violinist in an orchestra, if you don't practice at home, your violin is going to be all squeaky and horrible, and everybody's going to come together and make a horrible sound. But if everybody practices at home and then rehearses together, because you also need to learn to play together, it's amazing how musicians come together and they just know to come in at exactly the same moment with just the right amount of sound so that it blends harmoniously. That's how that happens, that alternating between practicing yourself and practicing together.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
I love that idea of having community and these shared experiences around our personal and spiritual growth. But I'm also really curious about how some of what we learn in this practice can help us bridge differences with people. So you mentioned the Obama supporters and the Trump supporters, and like, yeah. Is there any wisdom here which could be used to find common ground?
Well, let me start with something that's not quite as much of a giant step, because I'm kind of a planner and I like to find ways, techniques for getting better at something. So this getting better at relating to each other is something I've also been very interested in. And it just so happens my best friend in the world is Aaron Stern, who is the founder of the Academy for the Love of Learning. And he's developed wonderful techniques, by the way, longtime Buddhist practitioner, but from the Zen tradition. Anyway, he's developed these techniques that we can use to help ourselves to see, to kind of know the terrain of where our triggers are and be able to navigate when we're triggered in the face of somebody else. And also techniques for very quickly finding our ways to our common humanity in relatively short order. So the first evening of a workshop I did with Aaron Stern just a couple of weeks ago, people were marveling that within 2 hours, they went from not having met each other before to quite a deep place of warm, real connection with each other. Not just ways to navigate the difficult moments, but how do we efficiently find our ways to deep, meaningful, satisfying connection? Those are baby steps where you're already with people who are very like-minded.
Once we've had a chance to practice those baby steps with each other and those baby steps and bigger steps with our own selves, then I think we have a chance of more success with people who are really quite different from us and aren't co-conspirators in our study group. Their windshields look a lot different, but now we have much more of a sense of our common humanity, and we might just infect them with it. As I was saying about the person next to you in the grocery store, if I don't have a knee-jerk reaction, but rather am coming from, well, my habitual reaction becomes a much more compassionate one, and just naturally noticing our common humanity, quite often we can have success with people who are very different humans from ourselves. Imagine if everybody did that.
I know, it really is the hope, isn't it? That we could open ourselves up to being able to understand others' points of view without judgment and without this feeling that we have to be right just because we believe a certain thing.
Yeah, and belief is an infectious thing and it affects us in so many ways. There's a wonderful book called Connected, and in it, they talk about the science of how we infect each other. And since the real truth is something that none of us really sees very clearly at all, then how you make sense out of all those quirks and wavicles and things I was talking about before is much more fluid than we might think.
Tell me again how you originally found your teacher.
Yeah, well, we didn't really get to that. I was living in Boulder, so back to that. I'd taken a couple of retreats with Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein. And then I was practicing that for a while, and it felt good and kind of on track, but it wasn't quite my lineage. And so then I tried Zen, co-taught by a Zen Roshi and a psychologist who I'd had some training with in psychology. And that was great, but it also was not quite hitting the mark for me. And while I was taking this one psychology training, actually, one of the students in that training invited an American Lama, so studying Vajrayana, that's what's prevalent in Tibet. He came and taught, and as you may imagine, I had lots of questions, but I felt like, wow, this really seems like the right one for me. I liked that it had a lot of different practices, sort of one for any occasion, but also a clear graduated path of one practice leading to the next and the medicine getting stronger and stronger and so on. And so I decided to road test it, and I did a 10-day retreat at his center outside of Santa Fe. And just when I was going to go from one practice to the next, Thupu Sangak Rinpoche drops in. I didn't know he was coming. And he was teaching the same practice that I was about to do next. It just so happens. And then I met him and had a chance to have an interview. And although he doesn't speak English, there was a translator there. And that was my first contact with him. And the next time I met him, he came to my doorstep. I didn't know the first time, hey, this is my teacher. But then he came to my doorstep to teach the American Lama. And I got to sit in. And it was during that period of time that I realized, oh, this is my teacher.
You just knew it. It didn't even Yeah.
It's a journaling kind of thing. Yeah. It took me a bit.
And you learned Tibetan.
Yeah. Well, he never learned English. And so, yeah, I learned Tibetan, picked it up sort of like a baby.
That is crazy. That's amazing that you were able to do that. That requires so much discipline.
Well, it was kind of necessity. I was in my mid-40s and I thought, oh, I'll never be able to learn Tibetan. It isn't even the same alphabet. And
right.
It sounds different. I mean, it's really tough. And I just thought, I'll never be able to learn it. But if I could learn a few words to communicate directly with him, wouldn't that be great? And so I went to the University of Virginia and they had a 4-week summer program and I took that. And the first week I almost gave up because it's a different alphabet. And as I said, distinguishing the subtleties of sound are just about impossible for us. And I didn't give up. And I just kept going. I thought, well, maybe someday I'll get used to these sounds and it'll make sense. And I'll just keep going. And if I can talk to him about the weather and what's for dinner, but it'll be directly, I'll be so happy. But then one word led to another and I've translated and I've talked all day with Tibetans. Yeah. So it did happen, but I was at least as surprised as anybody else.
I find that so amazing.
And there's an analogy with that to meditation and kind of rerouting our brains using these methods. And that is that if you do something a little bit every day, like learning Tibetan, and I did just like 20 minutes a day of this little home course, and then I would have total immersion whenever I was at the monastery in Nepal where they didn't speak English, or I was with Rinpoche who didn't speak English. So that combination of doing the everyday piece and then total immersion once in a while, known as retreat when you're doing meditation, that's a winning combination to really make a lot of progress. And that's how you become fluent in the language. And it's how you become fluent with these methods.
I'm going to move into a completely different area for a second. And that is, you had contributed to a book called The Dharma of Dogs. And one of the things that the reviews say about this book are that dogs are carriers of special medicine and wisdom, and that they can be, in fact, our spiritual teachers. And so I wanted to understand your relationship with animals and what was your contribution to this book?
So my contribution was titled Lama Kusum. So Kusum means bodyguard in Tibetan. And I got this dog because I live on a mountain in Montana where there are bears trooping through and mountain lions and things like that. And so I have a couple of big dogs with me. So I named her bodyguard, Kusum. It turns out she was so timid, she's afraid of guests.
I love that.
85 pounds and she thinks he's a lap dog. Most of the interview that we've been doing, she's sitting at my feet. She doesn't fit in my lap.
But she wishes she did.
Oh, yeah. She was the star of my entry. I chose to talk about her because she has a gift that I think all dogs have, but she, of all the dogs I've owned and know, I don't know. I think she brings this one out the most. And that is that she just knows that it's all about love. Dogs just get it. And yeah, you know, there's all this other stuff and humans are very complicated and we keep going on and on making all of these noises. You know, I'm trying to imagine it from the dog's point of view, right? We go on making all these noises and sometimes there's angry noises and sometimes there's happy noises or whatever. And all she cares about is that we're in loving connection. At one point when she was like a young teenager, I was really sick with a horrible flu that went through here and it lasted for 3 months for some people. And that's what it did for me. So I was really out of commission for 3 months. And here was this very energetic, teenage, frisky, 85-pound dog. And I couldn't help her with that. So the amazing thing was that this dog would lie on my bed for hours at a time, snuggled up to me, not moving.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't think she was doing that because that was her favorite thing to do. She did it for me.
Do you think our dogs sense our needs in that way? Or do you think this is a special dog that can feel what you need and is so connected to you?
I think all dogs have an amazing capacity for feeling connection and they're all about feeling, aren't they?
Yeah.
They feel terrible if you're mad at them and they're so happy if you're happy with them and that kind of thing. Shepherds are a little bit more like that than, let's say, a bloodhound that as soon as they smell something, they're all about that smell because their olfactory setup is like, I don't know, many times more than it is in a shepherd. But shepherds, I'm just picking extreme examples here, but there's a whole continuum even within each breed.
Right.
But shepherds weren't going to reproduce much if their owners didn't find that they were trainable, really listening to their every gesture and command, because the sheep wouldn't get into the paddock. She happens to be a shepherd, so she was already kind of set up to be extra connected. But quite often they'll be connected and they'll want the love, but they may not always want to give up their needs for yours.
Right.
And she doesn't always, to tell you the truth, but somehow she knew this was different. And I have to say the other dog was nearby. She has a different personality.
Right.
Was something about this dog that was more extreme that way, even than most dogs. As you were saying, all dogs are very connected to feeling state and what's going on and very often want to be near you when you're meditating because it feels good.
Yeah, I used to say I thought my dog should meditate because he had such bad separation anxiety. If only he would just be able to sit and pause and see that the worst possible thing isn't going to happen when the suitcase comes out. So they're such special little creatures. Let me ask you another question, which is, what is next for you? You've created so much. You've learned so much over the last 20 years. You've created Namchuk, and you're teaching so many people how to meditate and going into these much deeper lessons as well. What is your plan now? What is your vision for where you'd like to go with all of this?
Well, a couple of things. One is we are still rather in startup mode. We haven't been around for so long. And so we want to help people to, first of all, find their way to the cushion on a regular daily basis, which is so difficult for us in modern life because modern life is like a tide going the opposite direction. And anytime we can go in this direction, whatever progress we can make, it helps the quality of our lives so much. And then we touch others who touch others, as I was mentioning before. And so the ripple effect in ways we can't even think of, like waiting in the line at the grocery store and how we respond to that, that can make a difference in the world. And we can all make a difference sitting on the cushion, being together in these learning circles and supporting each other from the learning circles into work we do in the world to make it a better place. And we focus on all of those, not just the personal and the community piece being what we were talking about before with those Sangha practices, but also we want to support each other to be of benefit on a larger scale. So there's that, which is sort of like a mini movement that we hope to inspire people with. And then on the horizon, we're building a couple of things out here in Montana for a longer term retreat. One is a student workers facility, which we hope to have finished in a few years. And students can come and do some work, environmental restoration and so on the retreat ranch. And then we do have this land called the Namchuk Retreat Ranch, where we hope to provide long-term retreat possibilities for people who really want to go deeply into that total immersion that I was talking about. Because it's so transformative. Mm-hmm. I've done over 3 years of personal retreat myself with these practices and done the whole pathway with the various levels.
And do you do these workshops in other places or people mostly come to Montana? So I understand the retreats are different. Those are long-term and deep learning. But do you do workshops around the country as well?
I do. So we offer them most often in Berkeley and New York. And we offer those every few months. And so somebody would just go to namchuk.org and look at what's on the events calendar. I've been invited to teach at Omega in May, and that'll be on our events calendar as well. And the Greater Good Science Center has invited Richard Davidson and myself to come to an event they're holding at 1440 Multiversity in Northern California. And Richard Davidson not only is a friend of mine, but he happens to be a neuroscientist who has worked with the Dalai Lama and really looked using hard science at the effects of meditation on brain and behavior.
I just am so grateful you were able to be on our show today. I really appreciate it.
I've really enjoyed talking with you today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Lama Somo for being with us today. You can pick up a copy of her book, Why is the Dalai Lama Always Smiling, at all major booksellers. And check out the Namchuk Retreat Center and courses at namchuk.org. Namchuk is N-A-M-C-H-A-K. If you have a minute, would you give us a review or rating? It helps a lot to get the word out. And if you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store. We'll see you next time.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.